as that which has been is the thing which shall be. So what has been done is yet what we shall see. Is anything new now of which one may say, it's new? No, it's not. Since that time to this day. That's Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. For today, little children, that's our daily proverb from the Ward Green Version, 2004, chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes. And we were looking at chapter 12, and we're just getting near the end now of chapter 12 and the conclusion of our article, Trojan War, from 2015, by yours truly. We arrive at some fantastic conclusion in chapter 11, that the book of Jasher in 534, where it says, in his 595th year, Noah commenced to make the ark. And he made the ark in 5 years, as the Lord had commanded. From sacred-texts.com, the book of Jasher. It's one source from which you might be able to get the book of Jasher. So, according to that verse, 534, from the book of Jasher, chapter 5, Noah built the ark in 5 years. And that appears right, because we calculate that Noah's ark was really built in 5 years, which is fantastic, because radiocarbon, which was how we arrived at that, should not be that accurate. And we found it using Whitelaw's correction table and the radiocarbon date for the ark wood stated by Mr. Ron Wyatt, but also, rest in peace, Ron, but we also calibrated the number that Ron had provided before correcting it, and we did our second order correction for the fact that there was a non-linear change in Mr. Whitelaw's table, and we ended up with a 5-year difference between the age of the arkwood and the date of the deluge, with the arkwood being 5 years older than the time of the deluge. In other words, the cutting of the trees we calculated occurred 5 years before our genealogical date for the deluge. And it was just staggeringly fantastic. I mean, of all the calculations I did, of all the research I did in the researching of the genealogy, this may have been the most unlikely of all the results that agreed with our chronology, the most unlikely confirmation. But it just, it's like the, you know, like they say, you know, the cherry on top of all of the delicious things that compose the genealogy. There were many different things that were remarkable about the genealogy. And I think we need to address something here, because I noticed there's a certain snobbery that exists in academic circles. You know, the people say, well, you mean, like I saw this comment the other day, somebody said, you mean that you have a better understanding than all of these many, many scholars? And, you know, as if to say you can't have a better understanding than all of these other scholars that are well recognized, right? That's the objection. That is, of course, that was the objection with which I was dealing front and center, first and foremost, right from day one. I had to face that. I had to be aware of that and face that right from day one, that I was going to be going against all these other scholars and all these other organizations, not all of whom agreed with each other, but many of whom had a deeply entrenched position where they weren't going to budge. Or let's just say some of them, perhaps I should say. The truth is, it's virtually all of them who are going to maintain their own viewpoint no matter what you say or do. And they don't agree with each other, even though they often or typically put on a false front where they claim they agree with everybody or that everybody agrees with them. But it's just not the case that people really have an accurate chronology in the world at all. They don't. And the reality is, it seems to matter. Let's put it in the humblest way. It seems to matter. Because when we get the true chronology, look what happens. Like, we got this incredible miracle of a result using the dating of the arc wood from a sample of petrified wood. And I read the other day that maybe petrified is the same as fossilized with regard to something like that. But, you know, you don't get fossilization unless you've got enough pressure on the wood. So the arc was discovered, in fact, by Mr. Wyatt, right on the side of a mountain, but it had slid down the mountain. If you read the arc of Urartu, maybe we should do that article next. I'm not sure, but it describes a lot of things in that article, and I just don't think, even if you do an article on any number, on everything, I mean, you can never cover everything, no matter how many articles you write on any subject, no matter how many details you attempt to cover, you can never get through all of them. But the arc, and even, you know, I'll talk a little bit about the arc of Urartu article right now, but I haven't studied it recently, but some of it I remember. Ron Wyatt had done studies about how would the arc landed, how would the arc have been able to land on the peak of a mountain, right? And he did studies using real models where he would build a model and he put water around it and he had a boat, you know, to a mock-up, that is, of the arc, where he would have the arc approaching this landing place, and he found that only with certain configurations of land would the arc tend to go and make a good landing, and in other configurations of land it would tend to drift away from the landing spot, so it wouldn't land properly, or it wouldn't be able to be easily moored, you know, it wouldn't approach the mooring site readily. But he did research on that. It had to do with how the water flowed around this geographical, you know, land structure that he had built, right? And I think he found that it was more of a crescent-shaped piece of land that was the ideal place so that the water that's produced, the water, what can I say about that, the water currents, I guess, that are produced as the water you know, as the waves move against, and now there wouldn't be many waves, you wouldn't think it when the water's really deep, but as water approaches land, that's, you know, that's when the water gets shallower, and that's when the waves become visible. So because the waves, you know, churn underneath the water, and as they hit the water, hit the bottom of the water, which is where the land is, they start to rise above. The water starts to rise above into waves. And so the waves can prevent the safe landing of a boat, or the easy landing of a boat. So anyway, there are a lot of things to consider, and that was one of the things that Ron considered, and you know, he was very, he achieved so many things, it was remarkable, it was absolutely incredible. He even said that he had found the Ark of the Covenant but for some reason he couldn't get reasonably good pictures of it. Now, you know, for anyone who studies the Bible, that's not a big problem to explain why you can't always get the right documentation. Kind of the same thing as the explanation of why people's electronics doesn't work when they have UFOs or alien craft, or was it they're not calling them UFOs anymore, but whatever. They used to call them UFOs, but let's call them alien craft. When the alien craft came, people's trucks and cars, the engines would just shut down because the aliens the technology of the aliens affected the electronics, whether deliberate or not, on the part of the aliens. But the extraterrestrials, let's call them, were able to, you know, disrupt everything that was going on. So just as a comparison with angels, and how angels can also, even in the case of, I think it was always angels that were mentioned in this regard in the Bible, how the angels were able to blind people so that they couldn't really see what was really happening at the moment, right? Or in the case of Jehovah's Witnesses, they said when the Nazis were in power, and when the Nazis would search the houses of Jehovah's Witnesses, they said sometimes there were at least accounts that said that sometimes the Nazi officers could not see the most obvious things that were right in front of their eyes, you know, because they'd been blinded somehow not to see them. Or, you know, in some cases, there were, of course, sympathizers who sympathized with Jehovah's people also. But the fact that you could be blinded is not a far-fetched idea. So the fact that Ron couldn't get pictures from the Ark doesn't surprise anybody who reads the Bible, I don't think, or who knows about God's people. It's just that the thing is, Ron did so many other things that were very easily verifiable, you know, but we couldn't verify that he found the Ark of the Covenant underneath the ground near Jerusalem. It makes it easy for his critics to say, you know, he's a charlatan and so on. And we can even talk about that. Like, we can talk about the idea of charlatans and so on. But, and really, you know, does anybody deliberately set out to deceive other people? Well, obviously, some people, it seems like there are people like that. But the deception really is, in order to deceive others, you have to deceive yourself, really. One of the things Ron also found was he found the Red Sea crossing, but on the east arm of the Red Sea, near the Gulf of Aqaba, or on that side, rather than on the Suez side. So he found the crossing. The only problem with the crossing that he found is that I saw a recent documentary that showed that they did verify that near the Gulf of Aqaba, or on that side of the Red Sea, that arm of the Red Sea, they found evidence of Egyptian chariot wheels and so on that Ron also found, but that it was evidence that an army had been marching in the very same ground, in the same area where the Red Sea, on that arm of the Red Sea, is present today. Near the Gulf, on the side of the Gulf of Aqaba, the eastern arm of the Red Sea. But the problem with the crossing was it was like a mile in vertical descent downward, as well as being some distance across, which would be significant in terms of miles as well. So how the Israelite peoples, with millions of people, would have crossed with all their wagons and gone down into the seabed 1 mile below, that is beyond my understanding how that could have been the case. Whereas on the other side, the Suez arm of the Red Sea, we saw a considerably easier place where they could have crossed, and the thing is, how did the chariot wheels get on the eastern arm of the Red Sea? It seems like maybe Ron was right about that too, that maybe the crossing did really occur on the other side of the Sinai Peninsula, not on the western side, close to Suez. So, the thing is, we know a lot of things that don't always fit with what we currently believe, right? And yet we've come to know that there are ideas that might be better than the ideas that we currently believe, but we can't incorporate those ideas even though they're better. In other words, yeah, there can be a lot of sort of conflicts in the teachings that we have, so, and the beliefs that we have that we share with others, and we might want to teach one method just because we can incorporate it better into all of our other teaching, even though it apparently disagrees with this newfound factual information that we've also come to understand and accept and even believe. It seems to me that there's no other time when the Egyptian army would have been marching down to cross the Red Sea other than the Exodus. It doesn't seem that would be too probable. But anyway, let's come back to the... I can't incorporate that, though, into our understanding of all the stations, like the Wadi Fayran and all that, which is in the Bible, and it's in the Sinai Peninsula. They're all named. All the locations where Israel stopped on the way to the Mount Serbel in the Sinai Peninsula, where Moses got the law covenant from God, and where all the Israelites camped. I mean, that seems like that's on the western side, and that's where they crossed on the western side. All the names of the place names and so on can be well aligned, and so unless all the place names were aligned according to some mythological understanding of where the Israelites crossed the Red Sea, which is also possible. But unless that happened, then there's no way to reject that they crossed near Suez and instead adopt the idea that they crossed the Red Sea on the other side. Now, maybe it's possible that the Bible got it out of order, and that they got the law covenant first, and then they went and were chased by the Egyptians over on the eastern arm of the Red Sea after they got the law covenant? Unless we can come up with a theory that fits the facts in a great, way of understanding, then there's no way we can reject our initial or preferred, understanding that they crossed near Suez. Anyway, coming back to the Ark story, the Ark had landed at the top of the mountain, but it didn't stay there for long. But there's a city where the Ark landed called Naxuan, N-A-X-U-A-N, that was named by the people who in recent days discovered this city, near where the Ark had landed at the top of the mountain there, near Uzengili in Turkey, where the Ark site still is, and where it's also the site of Noah's Ark National Park in Turkey, where the Ark had later slid down the mountain and come to rest at some lower position, still on the mountain, but lower down. So this upper place where the landing site was where the city was initially built by, evidently, the survivors, Noah, his three sons, Noah's wife, and the wives of Noah's three sons. And that city, Naxuan, is in itself a fascinating thing. I mean, it was drawn by an artist in some of the research that I did, I found that that was something I didn't have long to actually look at that or to research or stop. I wasn't stopping in the middle of my research to investigate, you know, all these different things. But I did notice there was some art had come into being because of the city of Naxuan. There had been an artist, a graphic artist, involved in portraying some of this, as well as all the researchers, you know, who must have done the archaeological research and so on into the place where the survivors had lived after they got off the ark. So they initially were just a few people, but they had children born to them, and then they would have built a city somewhere near the ark landing site. And apparently the first city that was built was this city of Naxuan, because it was so near to the ark landing site, right near the top of the mountain, which is where it would have landed. Now, why there are places today like Mount Everest that's at a higher altitude and so on, so that would have to be explained by the land would have had to have risen in the mountains of the Himalayas, you know, in that part of the world. These higher mountains would have had to have risen later, after the 3282 BCE landing, or 3281 was when they landed, a year after the time of the deluge. In 3281, when the ark landed, that was the highest point on Earth, perhaps. And if not, then Everest would have been not underwater at that moment, but when they landed, of course, the waters had already come down significantly, right? And that's why they were able to land. So maybe the waters have been much higher. So there are a lot of things to investigate, right? But it's not like they landed on the highest mountain in the world. So the mountains were there in the place where they landed, and the waters had come down low enough so that they could land on that mountain. And it's a mountain called, well, I guess we'll get to that. It's called Mount Judy by some people. It's called many other things, I think. And there's that wall too. It's like a cliff on the face of that mountain, and that is a very famous wall that was talked about in, I think it was, well, we don't know for sure if it was the same place, but it sounds like the description given in the very famous Epic of Gilgamesh, which is an ancient account, right, of a later, let's say, earth dweller who had gone to visit the ark site, evidently, to visit and talk to the person who had been the main survivor, or the father of the other survivors, who was obviously from the Bible. He was called Noah, but he was given a different name in the story, the Epic of Gilgamesh. And so, but also this idea of the crown too, this crown idea seemed to come about because the mountain where they landed looked like a crown. The cliff, it had the shape of a crown, and that may have been where the idea of having a crown on one's head came from. That whole thing, there's so much incredible and beautiful poetic kind of interpretation that comes from studying the Bible and studying the places where you know it's been found that the Bible has been verified, such as in the case of the Ark landing site. Like this is a place. The Ark landing site has this incredible, marvelous, magnificent sort of legendary status, right? Everybody's wanted to find the Ark and where it landed and so on. But and everyone wanted to find it so badly that when it was really found, people denied that it was found because they wanted to still find it. They still wanted to be the ones who found it. So they denied that this was really the Ark. Or the other thing is, because there were always unbelievers who would say, well, that's not the Ark because of this, that, or the other reason, or just because there is no such thing as Noah's Ark, according to some people, they would have to reject it. It can't be the Ark because the Ark is fictitious. If that's the case, that it was fictitious, then of course it couldn't be the Ark. But even if they believed that the Bible was true, they might be influenced by the people who were saying, no, that's not Noah's Ark, or because they could claim that it was some other natural formation and not a boat. You know, so they tried to argue it wasn't even a boat, but you could see the ribs of the boat rising out of the ground. I mean, you could see rivets on the side of the structure, you know, that would be able to be and were tested at laboratories that showed that it had titanium and aluminum in the rivets, metals that weren't even produced for many centuries after the landing of the Ark, after the destruction of all those foundries or, you know, metal refining places that it had existed prior to the Ark and so on. So the rivets that were in the Ark also showed a very advanced technology that had existed prior to the deluge. And, you know, I mean, the list goes on and on and on about how many things can be discovered and were discovered and are, I suppose, continuing to be discovered about the Ark. The Ark itself still exists. But also there were legends, but not just legends, there were stories that were accounts, historical accounts, of people visiting the Ark site in ancient times, but not, you know, I mean, a long time after the Ark landed, like thousands of years after the Ark landed, there were accounts of people who would go to the Ark site and pick up a small piece of wood, you know, or something from the Ark, because it meant a lot to people to find the place where the Ark landed, right? So I think that's from, I'm trying to think, it was from the famous Babylonian historian, I believe. I'm trying to remember his name now. I think there was an account there, but it was quoted maybe by another historian. I'm trying to think if it was quoted by Josephus, or I'm thinking it was, but I can't remember. But that's all talked about in the Ark of Urartu article, I believe, or in some other articles also that I've written about the genealogy, where we talk about Noah's Ark. What was the name of the famous Babylonian historian? Oh my goodness, I can't remember right now. Starts with a B, I believe. The famous Babylonian historian who also gave a list of the Neo-Babylonian kings, you know, in the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, for example. And I said the other day wrongly 584 for the destruction of Jerusalem. It's 587 BCE for the destruction of Jerusalem. But the 584 might have been the last exile of people from Jerusalem, actually. So it's not that far wrong. But 587 was the main burning of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. In our chronology, and in many, many people's chronology, that is the actual same year of that event. But and we've confirmed it many, many different ways. But what was his name, that famous, famous Babylonian historian? Come on. The name Bucoris keeps coming up. It's Berossus. Yeah. Berossus. Bucoris is obviously the Egyptian king that was said to have been killed by Shabaka. But Berosus was the historian who talked about, among other things, of course, the legend or the not just legend, but the fact that people would visit the Ark site was known about. It was known about by many people that there were visitors to the Ark site, even back in ancient times, you know, within a few hundred years of the time of Christ, people would visit the Ark site. So it wasn't that it was only discovered in our modern day. And, you know, it was known to have been in the mountains of Ararat from the Bible, where it said that. It was in the mountains of Ararat where that the Bible, in fact, landed after the deluge. So it's quite remarkable, all the things we can learn. But speaking about Ron, he also found animal dung in the ground when he dug down into where the structure of the Ark vessel had ended up after it slid down the mountain. Ron was able to dig down. Among all the other many, many other tests that Ron did, he was able to dig down and bring up animal dung and I think even animal hair, things that showed there probably had been animals, you know, in the Ark at the time when it landed, of course. And before they were unloaded from the Ark, so that the fact that there was still, you know, remnants of the, or traces of the animals, was another confirmation that it was Noah's Ark. But the list and the size, the dimensions of the Ark were exactly right, according to the cubit. You know, in the Bible, the books of the first five books were written by, or at least edited by, Moses, but in most cases written by him. But he used the cubit of the Egyptians, evidently, because that's what fits the sizes that they found the Ark was. When they found the Ark, was the Egyptian cubit, which is about 20 point some inches, whereas, you know, the normal cubit was like maybe 18, the shorter cubit, 18 inches or something like that. So the size of the cubit was important in all of that, too. It showed the Ark was exactly the right size according to the Egyptian cubit. And we know the Bible says Moses was taught by the Egyptians, right? He was raised in Pharaoh's household. So it all makes perfect sense as well with everything, including the Bible. That's 1945 hours North American Eastern Daylight Time, August 30th, 2024 of the Common Era, and I'm Ward Green. Thank you for listening and watching. I love you very much. In my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie, saying bye for now. And we've been studying the article Trojan War from 2015, and that was Chapter 12, Paragraph 11.